Good morning, and thank you for making it out in the snow, the cold, and so on. Please make sure that you sign in. The sign-in sheets should be somewhere in the middle, as well as the handouts. There we go. So, please make sure that you silence your cell phones, and you will, God willing, receive a link to an online evaluation form after the session. I would ask that you please make sure to fill that out. It's brief. Finally, everything that we're going to say here, as is true for all of the sessions, is not intended as psak. This is not intended as any form of a halachic ruling. Thank you very much for adding a table. Appreciate it. This is not intended as a halachic ruling. All of this is a discussion of an issue, and particularly so as we're dealing with something which is relatively new in the realm of medical halacha, and so there's a lot that remains unclear. Okay. Thanks. So I wanted to start by talking about what makes a total artificial heart different from other devices. So take a look, please, at source number one. This comes from an article that appeared in the RJJ Journal, the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society. You can see back in 2015, Rabbi Jason Wiener. And actually, while we're on the topic, I have here his book, if anyone wants to take a look at it afterwards. He came out with a book recently, Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision Making. It's not meant to be like in-depth drill down on every single topic that he's covering here, but I found the essays to be good, to be helpful. I found the footnotes to be even better. He's somebody who, he's a chaplain at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, and he has asked many, many practical questions to leading figures today, so you can get material through him that you won't find published elsewhere. So I find it to be a worthwhile read. So, in an article that he published in 2015, which he has an updated version of in one of his sections in this book, he has the following. One common technology currently used for such patients, meaning, as I added in brackets, patients with end-stage heart failure, is a ventricular assist device, which is essentially a mechanical pump. A VAD is usually connected to a ventricle, chamber of the heart that pumps blood out. Doctors know that, I hope. Usually connected to a ventricle on one side and the aorta on the other. A total artificial heart, on the other hand, is used for patients whose entire heart is failing. Whereas a VAD is connected to and assists one of the ventricles, usually the left, a TAH completely replaces both of the lower ventricles and serves as a mechanical substitute for the entire heart. A typical TAH thus differs from a VAD in that a TAH requires the removal of most of the patient's heart, which is going to matter as part of our discussion. It poses some fascinating questions. One question which we'll sort of touch on a little bit, well, no, we're going to touch on a lot, actually, is in source number two, Rabbi J. David Bleich writes the following. There are a number of practical corollaries to the theoretical question of whether or not the recipient of a mechanical heart is deemed to be a human being. Meaning, if you believe that having the heart beating, circulating blood is actually is necessary for the definition of life, so then you can make the argument that an implanted mechanical heart doesn't make the person a living human being, but actually renders them a machine. And he says, here are some questions that raises. May the recipient's wife remarry without benefit of a get? In other words, is she married to a living human being? Do his heirs immediately succeed to his estate? Because he's not alive. If the recipient is not a human being, is he then a corpse requiring immediate burial? That could be uncomfortable. I don't mean to be glib, but that's very serious for the people who are experiencing this. Must the family immediately observe Shiva, recite Kaddish? To be sure, these questions constitute a reductio ad absurdum and evoke the intuitive reaction that the recipient is indeed a human being. Thank you. Nevertheless, our intuitive response requires reasoned analysis and substantiation. This is really important. Meaning, it's true that we have an intuitive response of, yes, this person is a living, functioning human being, But within halacha, you have to have the system make sense. And whatever logic you have for defining life and defining death is going to have to answer to the fact that you could have somebody who is living whose ventricles have been replaced with this mechanical device.
That's not specific. Yeah. The idea of cardiovascular needs to be considered dead or alive is long established in the heart transplant.
Ah, so the heart transplant begins this conversation back in the late 60s. That's where the conversation begins. And that's going to factor a lot into what we're going to talk about now.
Organ harvesting in dead people is pretty well normative. It's a large number of people.
I want to go back to what you said first, because that part we're going to get to later. But the point that's made about heart transplants in general is certainly true, and a lot of the literature will be relevant here. But at least in those cases, after the transplant is over, they have what we would think of as a natural heart. It was just somebody else's. Here, it's a machine.
Approximately. In order to do a transplant, you have to take, you have to declare someone dead, even though their heart is functioning.
Correct.
So it's not, otherwise it would be murder.
Right, we're going to come back to that also, including calling it murder.
Function is the right. Basis by which life is defined has long been established.
So that's not necessarily true. That depends on whom you ask. And it's true that in certain circles, most medical circles, for example, if not all, it's been answered, but not in all rabbinic circles. And that's where this becomes an issue. So let's talk it through. We'll see.
Could you just remind us, what's the halachic definition of death?
Oh, we're getting there. Don't worry. No, we're getting there. We're not litigating the whole issue here, but we are going to deal with the parts that are relevant for this discussion. Absolutely. So the questions that I wanted to put here are three. You see them in source number three on your sheets. First of all, this is a question which applies way beyond the artificial heart to risky and experimental procedures in general. It comes up every time there is a new procedure, a new device. Jacob, age 54, is suffering from end-stage irreversible global heart failure. He is not deemed eligible for heart transplant. After evaluation, however, he is deemed eligible for clinical trials of a total artificial heart as a destination therapy, meaning not just transition, like this is going to be his heart. Personally, Jacob would try anything. May he enroll in the trial? Can he take the risks of being involved in the clinical trial of a new device? We're not answering any of these right now. I'm just laying out where we're going with this. So the first question is, how do we deal with experimental trials of a life and death type of procedure or device? The second and third, I'm going to come back to it, don't worry. The second and third questions are really meant to highlight something else here, which is the effect of technological advances on refinement of halachic thinking with real-world practical applications. In other words, new technology can force us to reevaluate how halacha views, in this case, life, but many other things. So I'm going to give an example that we're not dealing with in this year. The artificial womb. There's been a debate going for decades regarding what you do in the case where there's a woman who donates an egg and an embryo is formed and then it's implanted in a different woman. So who is the mother? Is it the woman who donated the egg, or is it the woman who gestated the child? Right, with a hypothetical third possibility that the child's actually gestated inside a woman for a period of time and then taken out and put into a third woman who actually is the one who gives birth. Then what would you say? Well, that question has been debated and discussed for a long time. A lot of ink has been spilled. Unsurprisingly, we don't have a definitive answer. We have multiple definitive answers. But the prospect of developing an artificial womb, which is no longer in the realm of distant science fiction, now forces a reevaluation of the question. Because for those who are saying it's the gestating mother and not the woman who donated the egg, so, you know, you think back to the children's book, Are You My Mother, right? Is the artificial womb now the mother? Because that's what did the gestating. So, new technology forces halacha to look back at its assumptions about how things work. And the same thing is true here. And take a look at questions 2 and 3, and you'll see the application. Sarah is a cardiovascular surgeon in training, which requires competency in implanting total artificial heart devices. Her rabbi believes that Judaism's definition of death is based on cardiovascular function. David, close your ears. That's what her rabbi thinks. May Sarah participate in this training program? Because part of taking the part of implanting the artificial heart, we saw it in source number one, is that you have to remove the natural heart. So is that then an act of murder before Tchias HaMesim, you bring the person back to life with the artificial heart? That's our second question. And then the third, that was definition of death. But what about definition of life? David received a total artificial heart, but a stroke several weeks later resulted in the cessation of detectable neural function. I did not go into all the issues involved in properly evaluating brain death. He cannot be weaned from the ventilator. However, David's total artificial heart is still maintaining blood pressure and circulation with no evidence of circulatory compromise. May the device be turned off? So that'll be our third question in the series of three. It's definition of life. Is he alive if the only major organ that's functioning is the artificial one that's been implanted in him? That's our set of questions. So what we're not dealing with, there are a few things that we're not going to deal with that are also fascinating questions related to a total artificial heart, such as, may it be reused? Or is it part of the dead body now? In other words, when you implant it, does it become part of the body, and therefore you're not allowed to benefit from a corpse, and you can't benefit from this anymore? May it be removed at all after death? Is that called degrading the body? Does the person have to be buried with it inside? Chevra Kadisha questions that come up.
Would that be a corollary where the nurse can do a heart transplant in the first place? If it's an artificial heart, if you can't take a heart out of a living person, that's one thing. But if you can take a heart from a person who now died and put in somebody else,
because there you're saving a life.
Yeah, well, to take the artificial heart out, going to be planning
to use to save somebody else.
Yeah.
Right, the argument can definitely be made. Like I said, I'm not planning on addressing it. I'm only noting that there are other artificial heart questions that do come up. There are many more that you could come up with. Let's go back to our first one. Risk evaluation. May one take the risk of receiving an artificial heart? And as we said, this is true for new technologies in general, clinical trials in general. We have already discussed, and I brought you a link in source number 4 to one of the shiurim on this, the fact that there is a religious obligation to pursue medical treatment. Right? That's a general principle in Judaism. Minishmartem ol nafsho zeichem. You have to guard your life. You have to pursue medical care. But our question here is about treatment which could be life-saving, but it could just as well be life-ending when you're talking about something that is experimental. So what would you say? What would you do with this question? Everybody was talking before.
Yeah. Sorry, which question is he reading?
What would you do with this? With the question of whether somebody is allowed to pursue this? This is somebody who, like we said, is suffering from end-stage irreversible global heart failure. Correct. Case number one. So yeah, he doesn't have long-term prospects as he currently is. On the other hand, going through this surgery, if it doesn't work, is going to shorten his lifespan. So the question is, how do you make that decision?
But what if it's not a child? What if he's to be offered?
Well, the idea that it's a trial, is that we're not sure how this is going to turn out. We have higher than normal levels of risk.
I think the answer is yes.
One second. The answer is statistics, but what statistic?
Well, you have to know the statistics.
No, but I'm asking the question. What percentage do you feel now warrants that he go through this?
That's a rabbinic.
I think you retreat into practicality. This man will die. This man will die in a very short period of time. That could be weeks or could be days. If he receives the heart transplant, there's a good chance he will not die. The statistic. Hang on. The definition is partly up to him, because it's his risk, and it's partly up to halacha.
Mm-hmm.
Halacha varies, but maybe as low as 10% or as high as 25%, in my opinion.
Okay.
That is not rabbinic. So the answer.
Listen, we said none of this is psak. We're good.
So the answer for him is he's trading a certainty of death for a suffix of life. So he's probably allowed to do it, but he's not forced to do it.
Okay, so Albert says you have a certainty of death versus a suffix of life. You could easily make the argument, though, that if you look at him in terms of his let's pretend for a moment, they're going to do the surgery on Tuesday. So his life expectancy for Wednesday, as of right now, is pretty good. Right? We never know, but his life expectancy is pretty good for Wednesday as of now. Factor in this surgery, and it plummets. Again, we're talking about when it's experimental and risky and so on. So that's you're looking at it overall in terms of short-term, long-term. But as far as how he's going to be Wednesday, the answer may be that you're taking too big a risk.
We have
a lot of questions. So
if it's a trial, then by definition,
yes,
there has to be equipoise. This would not be a trial. This would be, in other words, if it was not a trial,
yeah,
your argument is compelling. If there's therapeutic equipoise, why is your argument compelling?
Well, hang on.
We're gonna go in order here, Jeff, please,
well,
and then.
It's more than if it's just a trial. I do transplants. I say someone has a 20% chance of surviving, but I also have an 80% chance of shortening their life in the whole process of it. And this is not a trial. This is in the standard
right.
therapy. So it's more than just the risk of a trial. It's the fact you may actually shorten someone's life in the process.
Right, Leia.
So I'm just going on the back of that, is that any therapy has risks. I mean, obviously the numbers are different, right? But any medical therapy has risks and side effects. But with this, because it's a trial, you don't have any numbers really to give the patient. But you have to keep in mind that any therapy you're going to take on may shorten your life.
Very true. Yes, Alana.
So I was just going to say, I mean, these VADs are now fairly standardly put in,
yeah,
in hospital. And so I don't know if you could say that it's a trial per se. Each person is an N of one, so each person is going to be a trial. So you have to say, well, are you looking at it? And Halakha typically looks at an N of one versus numbers from it's a case-based assessment.
Halakha tends to be clinical rather than macro, yeah.
So, yeah, but from that perspective, they're not going to offer it to somebody if they feel that it's going to be completely...
Right, I mean, we're on the TAH rather than the VAD. The TAH being, you know, significantly newer and...
The question poses is yeah. a trial, that she is correct. These are not now trials. So that's why your question is a little... You're posing a different question than the topic at hand. You're posing the question of if there is a trial. At the trial point, there's that equipoise. When there's not a trial point, there is.
Right. There still are clinical trials going on with CAHs, meaning I found it online before I wrote the case.
Yeah.
It's not made up. But whether it's going to apply here or not, we have the fundamental question, which we're talking around. But the question is, what principle do you use to deal with this? Jonathan and then Albert.
Just one quick sort of question. If he's anticipating his death, potential death for him, does he fall into the category of Chayisha? And does that change, make any more leniency in the way you can treat him?
Say that again. Does the...
If they anticipate with no treatment that he could die very soon,
yes.
Does that put him into the category of Chayisha?
Yes.
Does that allow a lot of leniencies of what you can do?
Not necessarily. We were at yes until we were at no. We'll see. That's part of this question. But the basic principle in Judaism was really, it has two parts. One, Chaye Sha'a is of infinite value, and therefore cannot be considered less than Chaye Olam. However, given a choice between one infinity and another, I'll choose the longer infinity. And therefore, if you have a choice between Chaye Sha'a and Chaye Olam, you will opt for Chaye Sha'a. So the classic case, the Mishnah Berurah's case, a person goes into a fire and sees two victims, one of whom he can take out and maybe keep alive for an extra few hours. The other one he could take out and thinks that he could actually restore long-term life for. He can only take one. Take the one who could have Chaye Olam. So in that sense, we do have a sense of prioritizing Chayei Olam, even though we say every moment of life has infinite value. Albert.
You have to understand what trials mean. Before this gets to a human being, it's been done a large number of times, at the very least beyond simulation in animals. And it's been worked out to that degree where at least in a reasonably sized animal, it's going to work. So at the phase one trial, which I think everybody is commenting on, does it work or not?
Right.
There's a much bigger question. At a phase two or three trial, where you're getting into, are you going to be implement this? Are there safety issues? How does it work out? What's the chance it's going to work? You have a much better chance of this equating to Chayei Olam than Chayei Sha'ah.
Okay, fair point. Fair point. So what I would suggest is the following, and this takes into consideration what's been said here. You have a basic tension. Right? The tension that we have is, on the one hand, we have an imperative of extending life to the extent that we are able to do so. That's a basic principle. We talked about, v'nishmartem l'nafsheh seichem. There are various verses that one can bring to support this. On the other hand, the very act of engaging in this, and again, it may depend on what phase in the trial you are. You may be post-trials, and it's a 20%, 80%, whatever it is. But the bottom line is that there are levels of risk in engaging in this procedure, and at a certain point, you'll say, that doesn't justify risking Wednesday's survival, even if it would enable survival for 10 months of Wednesdays or beyond, if it were to succeed. So the tendency in halacha is to be conservative. That's the tendency in halacha, to say, shev v'al ta'aseh adif, better not to act when you could end up causing harm. We're not supposed to put ourselves into positions of danger. And therefore, when the early days of natural heart transplants were going on, the late 60s, the rabbinic response was pretty uniformly, don't do this. If you take a look at source number 5, I brought you the classic tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein. This one I think is fairly well known. His formulation is dramatic. I'm going with the English as opposed to the Hebrew in the interest of time, but you can see the original there. The heart transplants which doctors have begun to perform recently are actually murder of two lives. They actively kill the one from whom they have taken the heart, for he yet lives, because he was going with a cardiovascular definition of death. And they also actively kill, from an actual life of many years, sometimes even decades, the patient with heart disease. It is known that many people with heart disease live long lives, and in taking his heart and implanting the heart of someone else, all of them, should say, die shortly, most of them within hours, and some of them die in a few days. Even the one in Africa who still lives, even though about 6 months have passed, they have already agreed, as I have heard, that he cannot live for long. That was his feeling. This is the early days. What's interesting from a philosophical perspective, and it's not something that we're going to really unpack here, but it's something that should be we should deal with this at some point, is the macro versus micro. In the sense that halacha really looks, as I said before, at the clinical level, at this patient, he's not asking the question of, then how are we ever going to get to heart transplants that can work? As far as Rav Moshe is concerned, if it develops to a point where it's safe, that's great. But you can't be a part of that. Sorry? Exactly. No, that's actually what he is saying.
That doesn't take care of the first half of his objection. First half of his objection is
right. Time of death we still haven't talked about. We're going to.
Well, but I was saying,
God willing,
you can't eliminate his formulation. It's two parts.
Yes, right. It's true. His statement of don't do it is predicated not only on the death of the recipient, but on the fact that he believes you're killing the person who is donating the heart. That's an important point. Thank you. Yes.
So ignoring the murder here.
Yes.
The problem I have with Rav Moshe Alav HaShalom is that he's factually incorrect.
Yeah.
Because factually, nobody would have tried to put a heart into somebody who was going to live months or years.
Right, so I don't know what kind of information he was working with on the heart transplant candidates, so I can't answer that. I don't know, you know, what the information was that was given to him, or whether he would. In other words, I could understand his tshuva two different ways. I could understand it the way that you're taking it, which is he was simply misinformed about the health of the transplant candidates. Or I might argue that he was actually saying even a low percentage chance of living for a long time, where the doctors say there's no way with this that he's living more than a week or two. But people do make mistakes. Maybe he was saying they could live longer and it could be the doctor is mistaken. I don't know what his logic was. I don't know what information he was given. But
50 years is a long time.
Yes. Right? Ellen.
Just in terms of risk, does halakha have a magic number? Like if your heart transplant has a 20%.
So we're getting there. Yeah, we're getting there. So take a look at source number 6, where, just because there were others who wrote on this besides Rav Moshe, Rav Moshe is just the most famous, at least in North America, but Rav Unterman, chief Ashkenazi rabbi of the State of Israel at one point, in source number 6, he wrote extensively about issues of medical ethics. You get a little piece here of an essay on the point, on this issue of heart transplants. He says, when someone comes to take counsel with the rabbis of Israel as to whether in a case of heart disease it would be worthwhile for the patient to agree to the doctor's advice for transplant, they must say no decisively. And in the original, it's in bold. In the Hebrew, you can see it. I left it in bold there. In English, doesn't show up as well. But they must say no decisively, for such an operation has more likely danger than avoiding all treatment. This was also written in the, I believe, in the late 60s. I'm not 100% sure. It might have been a little later, but I think it's also late 60s. Rabbi Dr. Lord Emanuel Jacobovitz, in an article that appeared in the Journal of Medical Ethics, this article, as you see, I wrote there, was 1983. It says, Jewish law insists, firstly, that no vital organ be removed from a donor until death is definitely established by the actual cessation of all essential life functions. That's his definition of death, including particularly respiration and pulsation, not merely by what is termed clinical death, such as irreversible brain damage. That's a point we have to come back to, but that's what he's telling you. Wow. It insists, secondly, that such operations must not be continued unless they have passed the purely experimental stage and offer recipients a reasonably hopeful prognosis. Reasonably hopeful. Put a number on that one. But that's the sense of it, that if you have a high level of risk, we have not yet given a number for it, you're not able to enter into these trials. Or not trials, regular procedures. But once the odds increase for surviving this, and assuming that you don't have a concern that you're killing the donor, right? Whether because you're using a total artificial heart and therefore there is no donor, or whether because you accept that the death of the brainstem, whatever you're going to give me as your definition of brain death, is going to be accepted. Either way, once you've gotten rid of the problem of killing the donor, so you're just dealing with the risk to the patient, as the odds increase of survival, risk-taking tends to be left up to the patient. In other words, there's a gray area. It's not either you're not allowed to do this or you must do it, but there's an interim space where it's patient's discretion. So that the journal Ostia ran an article in 1987, Hashtalot Lev BeYisrael, which quoted both Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler and Rabbi Shabtai Rappaport, who is a grandson. You know that Rabbi Tendler is a son-in-law of Rav Moshe. So Rabbi Shabtai Rappaport married Rav Moshe's granddaughter. And both of them said that at the end of his life, Rav Moshe changed positions regarding the level of risk issue in the heart transplant. Whether we change positions on the brain death issue is a long, long discussion, and Rabbi Dr. Tendler takes one position and others take a different position, and we are not going through that right now. But they claim that he changed position on the issue of risk and risk taking on this. Yes?
Do any of the poskim here who are saying, no, we can't do it until, you know, experiments have been done, prove it's safe, deal with the ethical question, is it okay to take
you know, information done from unethical experiments. I mean,
right. So there is a lot of discussion about the about using that kind of information. It's beyond the scope of what we're going to do right now. Maybe I'll send out a link later because I discussed it a while back. In a sheer, and I want to first check what I did and see if I still like it because it's about 7 or 8 years ago. But yes, that does get discussed.
There's also a corollary, seems to me, that's always bothered me. That is, if all the Jews listen to the rabbis, then the only experiments that can take place are ongoing.
Right. And that's part of this whole challenge. That's what I meant when I said they're not dealing with the macro issue. They're dealing only with the clinical issue. This is true. So, generally speaking, they want to see a risk. They want to see an increased set of odds for survival. If you take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Mordechai Halperin writing in 1986, in normal surgeries, meaning not talking about heart transplants, the patient is considered alive, meaning he has the ongoing status of alive the entire time, as opposed to the heart transplant argument. But he enters a state of danger in the course of this normal surgery. But a patient may introduce himself into danger when the chances of healing are good. Tovim, there's your definition. If the odds are good. No, we're going to get better than that. Albert.
I apologize for going backwards, but I have a significant problem here.
Yeah.
We've been doing cardiac bypass for the better part of, 70 years now? And in the course of doing that, we physically stopped the heart at the very
beginning. We're getting there. We really are.
So my question, at the time of stopping the heart, not in a transplant, in a bypass,
yeah,
did we kill the person?
Right, we're getting there. That's in the next section, really. But Rabbi Halperin's position, that if this, if the odds are good, the patient is entitled to take the risk, is echoed by Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg in his article Hashtalat Evarim, in Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham and Nishmas Avram, and the patient now has the chance of taking a risk. So what constitutes good odds for this? Well, the Shmuz Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, writing a long time ago about this, well before there were any transplants, but dealing with the question of medical treatments which could harm but could help, in number 9, he says, in this case, the case he's addressing, since the patient will definitely die, that's the medical opinion, we leave the certainty and take the possibility that he might heal. Right? In other words, we say, go for it. Still, a doctor should not simply do this. He must be very patient, checking with expert local doctors based on the majority view, meaning a visible majority, 2/3, out of concern for those who are, I translated careless. It's not really a great translation. The Hebrew is kalei hadat, people who are frivolous. Maybe that is careless, I suppose. I'm not sure whether I like my translation or not, but he's dealing not with a modern case. Look, he's talking about 17th century Prague. And he says that before taking a course which could really harm the person, you can't just say, well, let's go for it. He wants a 2/3 opinion that supports it. That's very high.
That's the answer to Ellen's question.
No, but that's different. I think what he's saying is if he polled 50 doctors, 2/3 would agree that
good,
people should go for it.
Good. This is not quite analogous, because he's not saying that it is a 67% chance of success. He's saying 67% of doctors would say, we think this is worth doing, this is a good idea. Right? It's not quite the same. So even though this gets cited in many sources, I think you have to be a little more careful. And I'm not so thrilled with using this as a basis. Fast forwarding to the 20th century, take a look at Reb Chaim Odzer in source number 10. Early 20th century Poland. Regarding his honor's question about a patient for whom expert doctors say that without an operation, he will not live beyond 6 months. And with surgery, he might live. But the surgery is very dangerous and he is more likely to die soon. So you have now a less than 50% chance of surviving the surgery. It appears from the Gemara in Avodah Zarah that if he will definitely die, meaning without the treatment, without the surgery, we heal with this. We're going to use this method. For we are not concerned about loss of short-term life, where he could be healed even as a distant possibility, so long as they have not abandoned hope of healing him. So he is willing to go with a lower threshold. To say that where they said he's going to definitely die without this could be risky, but he is willing to go for it.
And he's willing to abandon short-term enhanced mortality.
So it appears. So it appears. He's willing to take the risk. However, again, this is up to the patient. And Rav Yaakov Emden noted this in source number 11, that if a doctor has certain knowledge, clear understanding, then you could coerce a patient. Now, leave aside coercion of patients. We've talked about the issue of patient autonomy in other sessions. But his point is, then there's a religious obligation to take this operation. However, if you don't have certain knowledge and clear understanding of it, then no, the patient is entitled to decline. Sheldon.
Anybody talk, it sounds maybe frivolous, but to say, well, let's wait 6 months, you know, until he starts to deteriorate. Let's not do the surgery, and that way we've got the best of both worlds.
Right, so that's the sort of statement that you won't necessarily find in a responsa. But on a case-by-case basis, I could understand seeing that kind of logic applied. For someone to say, right now, we think that he's okay. Not okay. Right now, we think he could use this. However, a year from now, odds are, he's still going to be a good candidate for this, and we'll have a year more experience with it. I could see that argument being made. I haven't seen it in literature, but it wouldn't surprise me in a case-by-case.
Right.
Sorry?
You're not strong enough.
Well, that's right. Right. Well, that was the assumption. Right. That's the assumption that I stipulated to Sheldon, that assuming he would still be a good candidate, if you have a risk that he's going to deteriorate in that time and lose eligibility, then no, this is then waiting is a bad idea. Yes?
There's always an optimal time for doing any of these things, and you start getting into subsequent kidney failure and lung failure and everything else, then the odds change. You know, we tend to offer people these things at times where maybe they don't need it immediately, but at the time when they have the high success of doing it, and it is a compromise.
Understood. Understood. Once the odds become even more positive, then we find a religious obligation to pursue treatment. So Rav Moshe Feinstein in number 12 speaks about that. Once the odds get stronger, then indeed there is an obligation that kicks in. Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Halperin, who I quoted before, says it as well. Although there are those, Shaul Yisraelius is cited as saying that, who says that no, as long as no particular option has a clear advantage of effectiveness, it's up to the patient to make that assessment. Okay, that's our first part of this. And the key thing that I wanted to take from this is that there is a gray area in the middle. The tendency in Jewish law is to be conservative. And therefore, I might have expected it to be sort of black and white. Either don't do it, or you have to do it. But you do have that area in the middle where it's up to the patient to say, I am willing to do this, knowing that I'm risking survival until Wednesday by engaging in the surgery on Tuesday. That, to me, is the key takeaway.
So there's still no numbers. Like, if it's 1% versus 0, is it okay for the patient to say, I'll go for it?
I understand what you're saying. And to my mind, you're not going to see a clear number. I think the two-thirds one does not apply for the reasons that we already discussed. I'm tempted, maybe wrong, to go back to what we've quoted from Rav Schechter in other circumstances. Rav Schechter's article, which we've quoted many times, Ve Love Hu Noseyas Nafsho, in which he deals with the right to decline treatment in an end-of-life situation. And his position is to divide, without going through the whole logic now, but to divide the playing field into three different areas. Meaning, one area, a treatment which normal people on the street would all say, I want that. At the opposite end, treatment which normal person on the street would say, no, I don't want to undergo that. And then the middle. And his position is, if it's a treatment that everybody would say yes to, he doesn't have the right to say no. If it's a treatment that normal person on the street would say, no way, I don't want to have that intubation, I don't want to have whatever it is, then the patient is not allowed to accept it. And then in the middle, it's really up to the patient. And there, the standard of, up to, Now, the end of it being up to the category in which it's up to the patient is really the vast majority of cases. And it's a slim minority at either extreme. I'm not sure whether he ever intended it to be taken that way. I should really just send an email and find out. That would be the smart thing to do. Maybe I'm going to do that, I think.
The ethics committee at U of T on the topic of cardiac arrest research takes Schechter's opinion of position one. In other words, they endorse the concept of what's called the implied.
Right, so that's a whole substituted judgment. Best on, right, that's a whole other issue. Okay, so let's move into the second area, because the second area is really the bulk of this, and we're already 40 minutes in. The second area is the most complicated, and that is the effect of technology on the definition of death. Is a doctor who removes a natural heart to implant an artificial heart guilty of murder? And yes, this will apply to the bypass surgery question as well. As is well known, we have great halachic debate regarding determining the definition of death, and the point of this year is not to reopen and explore that entire debate. We would need the day, not an hour and a half. What we do want here is to show that introducing this technology, like I said in the beginning regarding the artificial uterus, is going to necessitate reopening this debate. Because if we can replace the heart, then does halting the natural heart really constitute death? Even if you are a believer in the heart function as the definition of, or a cessation of heart function as the definition of death, what about where the heart becomes replaceable? So in order to understand this, and in order to see how those who accept heart function, cardiac function, in order to understand how they're going to deal with this, we do have to go back to the sources that say that heart is the determinant of life and death. The Mishnah at Alos, which I brought you in source number 13, is the standard source that's brought to support brain death. The Mishnah is talking about animals, but the same will apply regarding human beings. Domestic and wild animals do not communicate tum'ah, the ritual impurity associated with death. They don't communicate tum'ah until their lives depart. If their heads are cut off, then they communicate tum'ah even if they still spasm, as in the case of a spasmodic tail of a lizard, right? Mefarkeset is the Hebrew term. Meaning, if the brain isn't sending signals to the rest of the body, at that point the person is, or the creature in this case, is dead. And that's the basis, in general, there's more to discuss obviously, but that's the basis for the neurological position. On the other hand, if you flip the page to source number 14, Gemara in Yuma, dealing with the case of somebody who is in a ruin, and it is Shabbos. And in order to dig them out of the ruin, you have to violate Shabbos, which of course you do if the person might be alive. But once you know that the person under the rubble is dead, so wait till Shabbos is over. That's the principle by which this Gemara is operating. So the question is, you found the body. You know with 100% certainty there's only one person in the ruin. So we're not talking about, and you should keep on digging, maybe there's somebody else. However you know it, you know there's only one person in that ruin, and you found him. So, you start checking, as you're digging the person out of the rubble, you start checking for signs of life. Where do you check? How far does he check? That's what the Gemara asks. To his nose. The answer is you check up to the person's nose. You are looking for signs of breath in the nostrils. And some say to his heart. You have to check to the heart. Is the heart beating? Rav Papa said, there is debate when checking from the bottom up. Meaning, if you found the legs first, and you're working your way up, and you get to the heart, and the heart's not beating in any way that you can detect, do you keep on checking all the way to the nose? That's where there's a debate. But when starting from the top down, but if you got to the head first, then once one has checked the nose and there's no breathing, there is no further checking required. That is the statement of Rav Papa in the Gemara. Rabbi J. David Bleich, who is one of the leading supporters of the position that says that you wait until cardiovascular function has ceased, says this is the way to read the Gemara. This is the way he looks at it. Rav Papa is saying the heartbeat is what matters. The heartbeat is the central concern. However, it's sometimes easier to find respiration than it is to find heartbeat. Lack of respiration means there's no heartbeat either. That's the argument that Rabbi Bleich gives in reading this Gemara, and he's basing himself in part on Rashi. The second Rashi there. Not the first one. The first one we have to come back to, but the second one. He says, the debate of these Tanoim, these Mishnaic authors, one saying until his heart, one saying until his nose, is from bottom to top, when you started from the legs. When one finds his feet first and one checks toward the head. One says we can determine life at his heart, for his soul beats there. And one says until his nose, as sometimes one cannot detect life at his heart, but it is detected at his nose, the patient might still be breathing, indicating the patient is still alive. So that's your basis, in a nutshell, for the view that says that we care about heart function. Yes, one could make the point that had they had access to equipment that could detect brain function, they would have just gone with brain function. It's a what if. It's a logical what if, but I don't know the answer.
The nostril is the brainstem.
Why?
Because you have to have a brain to breathe.
Right? You have to have a brain to signal the lungs to breathe.
Yeah. And the heart is hypercapnic.
Well, the heart is autonomous. The heart can beat without the brain sending it. I'm silly. I'm saying medicine.
I have a different question.
Yeah.
What technology did they use to determine the heart was beating?
Also,
your
ear.
No. Yeah. I mean, they.
But seriously, the
stethoscope
wasn't invented yet until the 17th, 18th century.
Right.
So
yeah, you put your ear to the person's chest.
Yeah, but in that situation, there's too much noise. You may not hear.
No. Maybe that's why they're concerned about having to go to the nostrils.
That was the reason.
They used tubes.
That was the reason why they slipped the respiration.
Right. They go and say, go to the nostrils, because we won't always detect the heartbeat.
But I think you would... In that situation, you would stop breathing before the heart would stop. Unless it was a cardiac event, I think you would stop breathing before the heart would stop.
Right. So that I can't answer, except to say that this has the ring of a case they dealt with. In other words, this doesn't have the ring of an abstract type of a hypothetical. So whether it was because it was a cardiac event or what, I don't know.
It's a curious question.
Yeah.
William Harvey was 1640, so the pulse... There's a definition of death may not have been something they knew. Linnaeus, 1750, so there's no hospital.
And the answer is putting your ear to the chest. That's what it sounds like. But take a look at number 15. Take a look at number 15, where Blech gives his formulation. The necessity for examination of the nostrils is based upon the assumption that it is possible for life to exist, even though such life may be undetectable by means of examination of the chest for the presence of a heartbeat. Rashi succinctly comments that the first opinion maintains that examination of the chest is insufficient to determine whether or not life is present, quote, for at times life is not evident at the heart, but is evident at the nose. That's the position. Take it or leave it.
The definition of brain death, I think, has changed, too. The reason
yes.
is because now we're artificially supporting breathing
yeah.
and artificially supporting the heart.
Right.
Drugs and whatever, so it's not the same then in a natural situation as what.
Yeah, we're going to get to that, I hope, in the third part. The issue of, well, what about when the person is just functioning by machine? But in terms of this, right, this is going to create a problem for us. This definition of death is going to create a problem for us, as we said, not only in terms of a total artificial heart, but with open heart surgery in general. You put the body, even before you get the transplant, you put the body on a heart-lung machine, what have you done? Right? The heart is no longer what is circulating the blood. So much so that if you take a look at source number 16, Rabbi Mordechai Halperin says the following. This view that there is murder in a heart transplant depends in truth on the position of those who disagree with the Chacham Tzvi. We're coming back to Chacham Tzvi in a moment. But if this view were to be accepted as law, then it would prohibit not only human heart transplants, but also transplant of animal hearts. It's not about whether you're killing the donor or not. And artificial hearts. Still, it is clear this view is halachically incorrect. whether because the law does not follow Chacham Tzvi or for another reason. The proof is in all of the various kinds of heart surgeries, like open heart surgery, when the function of the heart, parentheses, and lungs, is halted entirely for several hours, and an artificial heart-lung machine temporarily functions in place of these vital organs. We have yet to hear any halachic resistance to these surgeries. Even though within the view of Rabbi Unterman and Rabbi Kasher, who had an article in that same Noam journal that I quoted before, according to them, there must be such resistance because of the certain murder and physiological severing of the flow of blood from the heart and lungs. He says, you may tell me that logically this is a problem, but I can tell you that no one is protesting heart surgery. He says, clearly we don't accept this. Why we don't accept this is Rabbi Bleich's problem, which he said at the outset. He says, you need to give me a systematic reason for why this isn't a problem. But no one is out there with a kol kore, with a big, you know, decree saying heart surgery is prohibited. It's an act of murder.
Yes.
Yet. Well, I think if it was going to happen, it would have happened by now. In fact, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg has a fascinating article on this in the journal Asya, the 38th volume of the journal Asya, or if you have the hard copy, the hardcover editions, it's in volume 6. It's a great article. I was going to add it to here, but I saw it too much material as it was. But he asks all sorts of questions, that some of which we noted in the beginning, about whether there's a need for new kiddushin for this person. He goes through heart surgery, right? Successfully, is he still married to his wife? And he brings all sorts of evidence from Talmudic cases in which people died and came back to life. Right? The classic Gemara with Rabbi Zeira, right? Where Rabbi Zeira is killed on Purim when somebody drank too much, and then he comes back to life. So does that mean he needed a new kiddushin? We're going to discuss some of that, actually. It's going to come up as we go through this. So what do...
By the way, like sometimes we'll be defibrillators up until recently that aren't still deliberately arrested.
This is an interesting point.
Sit back and wait until
So what are they going to say? What are the approaches to salvage a cardiac definition of death now that we are abrogating this whole thing on a daily basis in hospitals? So the first approach Rabbi Bleich offers is that death is not about the heart functioning or not, but it's actually about something called vital motion, which includes heartbeat, but can still be there even if the heart is artificially stopped. And here's how he comes to this conclusion. He points to a tshuva, responsum of the Chacham Tzvi, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Ashkenazi, source number 17, father of Rav Yaakov Emden. And this case involved a chicken. Everything starts with chicken. Here's the case, source number 17.
What's the beef?
A young girl once opened the belly of a chicken to remove its innards. It had been shechted already, right? So she opens it up. It's on the edge of a table. A cat was standing below beside her, anticipating the chance to eat whatever would fall down. The girl said she did not find a heart in the chicken. Right? She's worried this chicken is a trefa. It didn't have a heart. Her mother, owner of the chicken, said perhaps or almost certainly the heart had fallen down and the cat, waiting to eat whatever would fall, had eaten it. It is clear to all who have a wise heart and a brain in his skull that no creature can live, even for a sha'a. I chose not to translate sha'a. I didn't know whether he meant an hour literally. I suspect he did not. Without a heart and be like a healthy creature. Chacham Tzvi said, you know that there was a heart here. She slipped, the cat jumped up, whatever it was. But the heart is inside the cat at this point instead of being inside the chicken. And no, this chicken was not a trefa. That you can't tell me that the chicken had no heart. It doesn't make any sense. Rionis and Ibishitz in his Crazy Who Place, he offers the suggestion that maybe there was some kind of deformed heart that looked like other tissue and therefore she didn't notice it. But if you take the view of the Chacham Tzvi at face value, he's saying that you need to have a heart. And removing the heart is homicide. Right? Because if you take the heart out, the chicken is no longer alive. Didn't he just tell you that? That would seem to be the read. The problem is the Gemara in Chulin. People who are doing Daf Yomi saw this a few weeks ago. The Gemara in Chulin talks about what happens when you sever the trachea of an animal. Source number 18, the Hebrew is at the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the next side. Reish Lakish said, if one cuts the trachea, as part of Shechita, you know, you cut the trachea and the esophagus. So if you only had severed the trachea, and then the lung was punctured, even though Shechita is supposed to be in one gesture and so on, don't ask how this happened. This is a case which I don't know if it ever happened, but hypothetically, because it teaches us lessons, we go through the case. The Shochet has succeeded in cutting the trachea, and then something happened to puncture the lung. So the question is this animal a trepha? Because it was mortally wounded before you finished the Shechita. The lung is punctured. So he says, no, the animal is kosher. We view the lung as though it were placed in a basket because the trachea is no longer intact. Therefore, the lung that hangs from the trachea is irrelevant to the life of the animal. The trachea is a... You can't damage the lung any more than it is already damaged. Right? Once you've severed the trachea. That's the statement. Rav Acha bar Yaakov, though, then challenges him. He says, wait a minute. We see from Reish Lakish that one may invite a Jew to eat the innards, but one may not invite a non-Jew to eat the innards. Meaning, he says, now all kosher animals are non-kosher for non-Jews. That's the implication of this. Why? Because one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the laws that apply to all human beings, prohibits eating flesh from a live animal. Take flesh separated from the animal while the animal was still alive, right? So, all of these innards were severed from the body. Anything that's suspended from the trachea is what he's talking about. All of these things that have come from the trachea were separated from the body, right?
Before death.
Before death. So the argument is that it's Eiver Min HaChai. It's flesh from a live animal. And he says, why? For Jews, Kashrut depends upon Shechita. And you did a kosher shechita because you went on to cut the esophagus as well. So for us, it's fine. But non-Jews suffice with killing it, and it depends on death. These innards are like organs from a living creature. It's a remarkable perspective on it. But what it's telling me is that the animal is considered to be alive after the heart is separated from the body by the severing of the trachea, or these innards are separated from the body by the severing of the trachea. Ditto a Mishnah Gittin in source number 19 talks about another case that we would think is physically impossible. If they cut two, meaning the trachea and the esophagus, or they cut most of them, someone was being executed. The Romans had somebody they were going to execute, and they're going to do it by cutting his throat. So they cut through the trachea and the esophagus, or most of them, meaning most of the diameter. And the man hinted or said, write a get for my wife. They should write the get and give it. Meaning he is considered to be alive. He is considered to be alive, even though they've severed the trachea and the esophagus. The heart's no longer connected. But he's considered to be alive. I mean, it's connected to the vascular system, but it's lost one of its major connections.
No, it hasn't.
What do you mean?
Trachea and the esophagus are up here.
Yes.
Your heart's down here.
Yes.
In order to sever a connection to the brain, you've got to go a lot further.
Not the connection to the brain. You're assuming we're talking about connection to the brain. That's not what I'm saying. One of the major, I don't know what to call it, vessels is the wrong word, but what's the word I should use? Is now severed for the trachea.
No, the trachea consists of the respiratory system.
Correct.
So the vascular system has not been compromised. You didn't get the aorta. The aorta would have to be severed. So the issue here, the death, is from hypoxia, from not getting enough oxygen.
Right, but I'm not talking about
That takes a long... you have a few minutes still. So he could still motion, he could still do something, because there's still residual oxygen.
All right, we're talking about two different things. You're giving me the rationale for how he could have written, or how he could have signaled about the get.
Yeah.
Right, no, that's
so
true.
He's not dead yet.
Right, no, that's true. I'm not arguing that point. That could happen. I was talking more about the oddity of imagining him actually doing this.
Yeah, it is odd.
But separate from that, you've by separating the trachea, by separating the trachea, what you're doing is separating the entire respiratory system from its major trunk,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And therefore, the heart is considered to be separated as well.
Why?
Because isn't the heart, now I'm going to, I hope I'm not getting this wrong, but isn't your pulmonary artery, right, running from the heart
to the lungs?
Yeah. So that, by separating the trachea, you've now damaged that part of the system.
No.
Why not?
I think anatomically, I think what people are missing, if you cut the trachea and esophagus, you probably cut the carotid and the jugular as well.
So you're probably...
No, but I'm not... they're not working with that. They're not working.
The thing is, the pulmonary artery provides the oxygen. The oxygen comes from the lungs.
Right.
So you have a bit of residual. Like, that's why that 4 minutes of recess... So you have a bit of residual,
right,
that's still functioning, but then you're not getting any more oxygen in because the connection has been severed.
That's not the tumor logic. Your intestines can still be operating when your esophagus is cut, can't they?
Yeah.
Well, yes.
But the Gemara assumes they're not. They're, because they're connected to the digestive system. Once you cut the esophagus, you've now removed it in the entire system that is connected with it from the body of the animal, as it were.
Okay.
Similarly, if you do the trachea, since the heart is functions, has to deal with the trachea because of the oxygenation system of the body.
Theoretically.
I'm just saying that's a comment. I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying it's a
sentence. You're still sucking air through the open trachea, theoretically, too. Right.
We do tracheostomies on people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. What I'm going to do though is go further here at this point because it's a minor point within it, and I don't want to lose some of the major things we have to get to. Yes.
Aren't Jews also required to observe the seven mitzvahs of B'nai Noah?
Yes and no. But I'm going to make it easier for you by reading the run that's coming next.
Okay.
The source number 20. Then he says, I don't get this whole idea that it's viewed as though we're placed in a basket. He says, saying it, the lung in this case, is like it was placed in a basket is not clear to me. If so, the animal is entirely dead. How could cutting the esophagus afterward permit the animal? He's asking the question about all shtita. He's saying, the animal is already dead once you've severed the trachea. And therefore, cutting the second siman, cutting the esophagus, shouldn't be able to create a kosher shchita. You did shchita on a dead animal. That may work for halal, but it doesn't work when you're talking about when you're talking shchita. So the question then that we're faced with is this: the Chacham Tzvi has told me that removing the heart is homicide. Right? That was his statement. His statement was the chicken cannot live without a heart. However, as the Ran makes clear, and the Ran was really the one I wanted to make sure to get to with this, he says cutting the trachea is not considered to kill, can't be considered to kill the animal. So he says, so Rabbi Bleich comes up with the following rationale, source number 21. He says, Rabbeinu Nisim, from source number 20, apparently reasons that recognition that the animal has in fact not died is evidenced by the fact that the heart continues to pump blood through the circulatory system. Logically entails acceptance of the position that the heart is not already, quote, in a basket, but continues to function as an integral part of the organism. In other words, and this is where Leah was trying to go, I think, the heart is still doing its job. Trachea severed, trachea not severed, the heart is still doing its job, circulating blood. Hence, in the opinion of Rabbeinu Nisim, so long as the heart remains attached to the body and functions as the animating force of the circulatory system, it is deemed to be an integral, he's missing a word, but it should be part, of the body, even though it is no longer attached to the body by means of the trachea. According to Rabbeinu Nisim, the heart cannot be deemed to have been, quote, placed in a basket, so long as the circulatory system is operative. That's the position that Rabbi Bleich takes. It's not about whether the heart is connected properly to all the different parts. That's not what he cares about. It's really circulation that he cares about. And he sees this view in a statement of the Chasam Sofer in source number 22, in which the Chasam Sofer, dealing with the identification of death, he says about the heart, it lies there like a stone without any beating, and then the breathing stops. We only have the position of our holy Torah that he is dead. I'm not going into the Chasam Sofer's case. It's a fascinating one. But the point is that, and this is Rabbi Bleich's point, that he says there is no beating going on, it's the circulation. And now we go back to that Rashi that I skipped in source number 14, the first Rashi there, talking about checking the body of the person who's stuck in the ruin. So Rashi said, how far does he check? If the person appears dead, not moving. He catches those words. Why did Rashi throw in the words, not moving? He says this refers not to moving like moving one's arm, but that there's no motion going on within the body, which is the way he reads it. And he says that's why we read about the lizard's tail. Right? We said that the lizard spasmodically moving the tail, where its head has already been cut off, doesn't count as movement. Why did the Mishnah need to emphasize that the spasming of the tail is meaningless? Because other movement would be meaningful. This is not, but movement in general, he says, is. Now, you may know, because I think he's from Toronto originally, Dr. Noam Stadlan. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he is very upset about this position. I didn't bring his material on it because really we would have nothing else to say going forward. He has a lot to say about this. But he's very frustrated by, and I brought you links to two articles of his on it, one from Hakira and the other one from a blog, in which he talks about vital motion, this idea that Rabbi Bleich is using, and says, it's too nonspecific, it's too broad, it's too much of just a solution to a problem, as opposed to a logical theory. He really does not like this idea at all. But that's solution number one. Not so much that it's circulation, but that it's vital motion. And the reason I distinguish is because maybe other motion will count as well, not just circulation, if I take this view. You mentioned the intestines can still function. Maybe that would be considered motion that indicates that the patient is alive, according to this view that said, until now, that it's cardiovascular function.
But aren't you circling back to the brain death?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if you accept a priori that brain death is the sine qua non of life.
Which he doesn't.
Right.
Right.
What situation would this be? Vital motion? I'm not sure.
The case in which the throat has been cut, right, but the heart is still beating. There's still blood going around the body. For the next couple of minutes, he's still alive. The get can be written and so on. The answer, by the way, just in case anyone was wondering, the reason why we care about writing the get at this point is to prevent a Yibum situation, where she has to worry about whether she's going to marry or not marry her brother-in-law, who may or may not be willing to cooperate. So that's why the get becomes very important. The second rationale that's offered is that it's not really about the heart, it's about circulation. Not vital motion, but circulation in particular. And if you take a look at source number 24, you see where Rabbi Bleich seems to support this idea. That he says there is room to say that even cardiac activity is not an independent sign of life, but only because the heart presses and circulates blood in the arteries and veins. So it's not all motion, it's the flow of blood in particular. I'm actually going to halt the questions on this, just because there's so much to say and so little time for it. So I'll come back to questions in a bit, but I want to make sure to get through this. Because the third one is the one that's most important when we deal with the question of how we do bypass surgery, how we do heart surgery, and so on. The third approach is to say, if the cessation is reversible, the person isn't really dead. If the cessation of heart function is reversible, the person is not truly dead. I was discussing this with my youngest about a year ago, or maybe more than 2 years ago.
Reversible, they were not.
Then they weren't really dead. And I was trying to explain this point of view to him. So he said, so it's like the neshama hasn't left, in other words. As long as you could restart the heart, the neshama is still there.
Mm. That's the cardiac arrest.
Yes. So this comes up in a variety of cases. The Birka Yosef, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, in source number 25, dealt with this in the case I mentioned before about Rabbi Zeira, who was killed on Purim, but came back to life on Shushan Purim. So he said, there's room for doubt. The wife of Rabbi Zeira, when her husband was slaughtered and he died, certainly her marriage ended, and she was permitted to marry anyone. When Rabbi Zeira was revived the next day, he needed to perform a new kiddushin, for his wife was single. Or perhaps, that which a woman acquires freedom when her husband dies, is only when he dies and remains dead. Right. There are other ways to read the story of Rabbi Zeira. I should note, not every read of this story of Rabbi Zeira is that he was actually dead. But that's certainly the view that's being taken here. And the Chidah, Rabbi Azulai, tries to prove that a reversed death is not death from Rabbi Yossi in the Yerushalmi and Gittin. There is a Mishnah in Gittin that deals with the following. A man says, I'm going away on a long trip. He's worried something might happen to him on the trip and his wife might be stuck. So he says, here's a get that's conditional on my not returning within 12 months. If I'm not back in 12 months, the get is a valid get. That's what he did. So what happens if he dies within the 12 months? Is she a widow or is she a divorcee? Right? You haven't yet hit the 12-month mark. The practical application of it, as Rashi notes on the Gemara in Gittin, is Yibum. Right? Does she have to either marry her brother-in-law or do chalitza? Or can you say she's a divorcee? Right? Does she need to wait for 12 months to end? And then at that point, she no longer has to worry about yibum or chalitza. She can't get married until the year is over, and now she's a divorcee. Is that the way that we're going to look at it? Or do I say he's not coming back? Right? Literally, he's not coming back. So therefore, the get is already valid, because we know that at the end of 12 months, he won't be here. You know, can you make that argument? So the Babylonian Talmud has this whole discussion and is not clear on the conclusion, but the Talmud Yerushalmi has an answer from Rabbi Yossi, which is in number 26. May she marry? Is she allowed to get married? Rabbi Chagai said she may marry. Rabbi Yossi said she may not. She's not allowed to marry. Why? Perhaps miracles were performed for him and he lived. Who knows? He might come back to life within the year. Now, the commentators all discuss, was he talking about the Yibum case, general marriage, but I'm not going into that right now. But the Birka Yosef, Rabbi Azulai, comments what you see in source number 27. He says, where we hear someone has died, we do not worry at all about a miraculous revival. Meaning, if you really take Rabbi Yossi seriously, then why are you stopping with the case where a guy gave the get after 12 months? This should be a concern in all cases, right? We have all sorts of cases where there's testimony that someone has passed away, and we accept that to allow her to remarry, but maybe now you have to worry. Maybe he came back to life. Death isn't final either. So he says, we don't worry at all about that. That never happens. But we learn from this Yerushalmi that if after dying miracles happen and he lives, his wife is still married to him. And his certain death does not matter, since in the end he is alive. And he says, that's the key lesson, the takeaway here. No, we're not really worried that people came back to life. That's not a concern. However, if somebody did come back to life, their marriage remains. Because what this indicates is their death was reversible. So Rabbi J. David Bleich uses that principle to solve the question of how it is that we do these surgeries. Source number 28. Similarly, when the halachically posited criteria of death, including cessation of cardiac activity, are manifest, but the patient is subsequently resuscitated, it must be assumed that the patient was not dead during the intervening interval. See Rav Moshe Sternbach, or Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Thus, it is only irreversible criteria of death which establish that death has indeed occurred. That is, to my mind, the best out of the three solutions. As opposed to saying it's vital motion, or as opposed to saying as long as blood is flowing, you know, through the circulatory system, to say it has to be irreversible. And therefore, all the bypass surgeries and the transplant surgeries are not acts of murder, even though you halted cardiac function. And even though you're telling me that heart function is the definition of death, because it's not irreversible, we're going to be we'll be okay with it. This has its analog, of course, in the tests that are done to determine brain death. The meaning, all of those require that you rule out other reasons why the brain function isn't being detected. So it's the same thing. You have to identify it as being irreversible. It isn't simply, well, this stopped now, so therefore the person is dead. Okay. I think what I'd like to do is go through the last part of this, which is the quickest part, and then I'll take the questions that anyone's been holding from here. Is that okay? Okay. So the last part of it is the definition of life, our third case. The patient who had a total artificial heart, they now have, as I brought you in source number three, they had a stroke. There is no detectable neural function. Patient cannot be weaned from the ventilator, so the machines are doing the work. The total artificial heart is doing its job. As I understand it from the literature, you don't even need blood pressure medication. The heart is taking care of it.
You have a detectable pulse.
Sorry?
Many of them now use non-pulsatile flow machines.
So they may not be a pulse.
You walk into your office with no pulse.
Wow. That's cool. Right.
So much for that criteria.
Yeah. So building on something that we've discussed in previous sessions, we have a general principle of not withdrawing treatment. But if there's no evidence of life beyond this machine, is turning it off still withdrawal of treatment? How do we view this? So there was a lot of discussion regarding this with defibrillators, meaning it's not new with a total artificial heart. I had a case when I was a shul rav in which someone had his brain had herniated and all sorts of things that go along with that, but he had some kind of, I don't know the specifics, some kind of pacemaker implanted, and his heart was still beating. And so the question was, he's dead, but what do you do? What I did was ask a Shiloh, because I wasn't answering that one.
Not a rare question.
No, of course it comes up. So that was the question then. There's responsa in the Menchas Asher on this. But even if one may turn off a defibrillator or a ventilator, at least there, the argument can be made that you turn it off at a moment when it's not functioning, and therefore you aren't killing the person as much as preventing this device from assisting with the maintenance of the person's life. Depends on the circumstances of the case, obviously. But with a total artificial heart, there is no moment like that. This is what it's doing. If you turn it off, you have stopped the heart from beating. So again, if you say, I work with neurological criteria, then there's no conversation. Once the brain isn't doing it, the case is closed. But the question is, what if you don't take that perspective? Could you say, and this is one of the arguments that Rabbi Wiener explores in his article on this, that source number 29 will apply here. The Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, distinguishes between withdrawing something that is keeping a person alive and withdrawing something that is preventing death. And could the argument be that you're only withdrawing something that is preventing death, but not something that's actually keeping the person alive? So I brought you some quotes from his piece on this. In number 30, he says, one situation in which many rabbinic authorities do permit extubation is in a case in which the patient shows definite clinical signs of already being deceased and the respirator is the only thing keeping the body alive. In such a case, it can be argued that the respirator is preventing the soul from leaving the body, and it may thus be seen as an impediment that may be removed. Therefore, those rabbinic authorities who accept neurological criteria of determining death would likely permit TAHD activation once a patient is declared brain dead. And he got that from Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg. Even some of those authorities who do not accept brain death as a valid halachic definition of death may still permit deactivation once the patient is declared brain dead. Because at the very least, such a patient may be considered a gosase, somebody who is at the moment of death, and the TAH could be seen as an impediment preventing the soul from leaving, what the Rama did in number 29, as some rule regarding ventilators. Indeed, Professor Avram Steinberg reported to this author that Rabbi Shmuel Halevi Wasner ruled that although he opposed the brain death criteria, in case of an artificial heart, the combination of brain death with lack of a natural heart could be defined as the moment of death. So he's willing to go that route. Rav Asher Weiss says something which requires explanation. In number 31, he says, Rav Asher Zelig Weiss has suggested that as long as a person is alert and able to function, despite not having a natural heart, they are obviously still to be considered alive according to Jewish law. On the other hand, if a person is completely unresponsive and shows all other signs of death, it seems it should be permissible to deactivate the total artificial heart. It's an unpublished responsum, at least as of when he published that article. The specific guidelines and criteria for this determination are yet to be worked out. Meaning, what do you mean when you say there's no function, there's no... what was his language? If a person is completely unresponsive and shows all other signs of death, so what if the intestines are still functioning? Will that be considered? No, this person is still alive because there is part of the body that's doing what it does. So this is a very difficult thing to implement, which is maybe why the responsum is still unpublished. It could be that he's trying to figure that out before publishing this. But that's a second view. So you have the view that says this is fine. He doesn't have a natural heart, and his brain is no longer doing anything that we detect as life, and that's enough. You have a second view that says you need to not have signs of life from the body, whatever that means. And then Rabbi Bleich takes his vital motion idea in source number 32, and he says, as Rabbi J. David Bleich has ruled, a patient whose own heart has been removed and replaced with an artificial heart and is sustained on a ventilator and incapable of spontaneous respiration is considered dead by halacha only when incapable of any spontaneous motion whatsoever, including motion of internal organs, e.g. peristaltic action of the small intestine. Until then, such a patient must be treated. It will be forbidden to deactivate their TAH. Rav Bleich is consistent with what he said in the very beginning of this shiur, which is he wants things to work logically within the system, and you're answerable to that logic. And without that, without any logical way to show why this should be different, that's the position that he's going to take, as hard as it may be for people to wrap their minds around it. But it's a logical position that derives from his understanding that that vital motion in this case is the definition of life. So what we've gotten from this, please make sure, by the way, where are the sign-in sheets? There's one there. Just make sure, please, because once again this year I had people who called me up afterwards saying that they had been at a session, but I didn't have their name on the sign-in sheet. If you want to be able to get your letters, you need to make sure especially that you signed in. Also, if you want follow-up, because I'm planning on sending that question to Rav Schechter that came up during the shiur, make sure that you're on the list. But what emerges from this, and then I'll take the questions that remained. Number one, in terms of risk evaluation, we do have the idea that where there is a chance, we haven't really given good numbers on it, but a chance that this could be effective and doctors are recommending it, the patient has the ability to say, I want to go this route, knowing that it risks their short-term survival. They aren't obligated to do it, but they do have that option of doing so. That's number one. Number two, the introduction of this technology of the artificial heart challenges those who argue that cardiac function is the definition of life. However, they do come up with ways to deal with this problem, whether it's vital motion, circulation of the blood, or the argument that it's reversible, and therefore it's still and therefore the patient is still considered to be alive. And then the last point, in terms of withdrawing it, you have a range of opinions which are going to have to be clarified further, because this is a live question. Sorry, that wasn't intentional. This is a question that is very much active these days. Okay, questions that first. Thank you very much. Questions that remain, Jack.
This one, the last case.